Side 5. The Stars, My Destination. Continuing on page 168.
What? Gisbella came to the glass wall separating the rooms. You, Saul? Patriotic?
He nodded, almost guiltily. It's ridiculous. Grotesque. But I am. You've changed me completely. I'm a sane man again.
He pressed his face to the wall, too, and they kissed through 3 inches of lead glass.
Mare Nubium was ideally suited to the growth of anaerobic bacteria, soil organisms, phage, rare molds, and all those microscopic life forms essential to medicine and industry, which required airless culture. Bacteria Incorporated was a huge mosaic of culture fields traversed by catwalks spread around a central clump of barracks, offices, and plant. Each field was a giant glass vat, 100 feet in diameter, 12 inches high, and no more than 2 molecules thick. A day before the sunrise line, creeping across the face of the moon, reached Mare Nubium, the vats were filled with culture medium. At sunrise, abrupt and blinding on the airless moon, the vats were seeded. And for the next 14 days of continuous sun, they were tended, shielded, regulated, nurtured. The field workers trudging up and down the catwalks in spacesuits. As the sunset line crept toward Mare Nubium, the vats were harvested and then left to freeze and sterilize in the 2-week frost of the lunar night. Jaunting was of no use in this tedious step-by-step cultivation. Hence, Bacteria Incorporated hired unfortunates incapable of jaunting and paid them slave wages. This was the lowest form of labor, the dregs and scum of the solar system, and the barracks of Bacteria Incorporated resembled an inferno during the 2-week layoff period. Foyle discovered this when he entered Barrack 3. He was met by an appalling spectacle. There were 200 men in the giant room. There were whores and their hard-eyed pimps, professional gamblers and their portable tables, dope peddlers, moneylenders. There was a haze of acrid smoke and the stench of alcohol and analog. Furniture, bedding, clothes, unconscious bodies, empty bottles, rotting food were scattered on the floor. A roar challenged Foyle's appearance, but he was equipped to handle the situation. He spoke to the first hairy face, thrust into his.
Kempsey?
He asked quietly. He was answered outrageously. Nevertheless, he grinned and handed the man a 100-credit note.
Kempsey?
He asked another. He was insulted. He paid again and continued his saunter down the barracks, distributing 100-credit notes in calm thanks for insult and invective. In the center of the barracks, he found his key man, the obvious barracks bully, a monster of a man, naked, hairless, fondling 2 bawds and being fed whiskey by sycophants.
Kempsey,
Foyle said in the old gutter tongue.
I'm digging Roger Kempsey.
I'm digging you for broke,
the man answered, thrusting out a huge paw for Foyle's money.
Gimme.
There was a delighted howl from the crowd. Foyle smiled and spat in his eye. There was an abject hush. The hairless man dumped the bawds and surged up to annihilate Foyle. 5 seconds later, he was groveling on the floor with Foyle's foot planted on his neck.
Still digging, Kempsey, Foyle said gently. Digging hard, man. You better finger him, man, or you're gone is all.
Washroom,
the hairless man howled.
Hold up, washroom.
Now you broke me, Foyle said. He dumped the rest of his money on the floor before the hairless man and walked quickly to the washroom. Kempsey was cowering in the corner of a shower, face pressed to the wall, moaning in a dull rhythm that showed he had been at it for hours.
Kempsey,
the moaning answered him.
What's the matter, you?
Clothes,
Kempsey wept.
Clothes, all over clothes, like filth, like sick, like dirt. Clothes, all over clothes.
Up, man, get up.
Clothes all over clothes. Like filth, like sick, like dirt.
Kempsey mind me, man. Orell sent me.
Kempsey stopped weeping and turned his sodden countenance to Foyle.
Who? Who?
Sergei Orell sent me. I've bought your release. You're free, we'll blow.
When?
Now.
Oh, God! God, bless him, bless him!
Kempsey began to caper in weary exultation. The bruised and bloated face split into a facsimile of laughter. He laughed and capered, and Foyle led him out of the washroom. But in the barracks he screamed and wept again, and as Foyle led him down the long room, the naked bawds swept up armfuls of dirty clothes and shook them before his eyes. Kempsey foamed and gibbered.
What's the matter, him?
Foyle inquired of the hairless man in the gutter patois. The hairless man was now a respectful neutral, if not a friend.
Guess it's for grabs, he answered. Always like that, him. Show old clothes and he twitch. Man.
For why already?
For why? Crazy, so.
At the main office airlock, Foyle got Kempsey and himself corked in suits and then led him out to the rocket field, where a score of anti-grav beams pointed their pale fingers upward from pits to the gibbous earth hanging in the night sky. They entered a pit, entered Foyle's yawl, and uncorked. Foyle took a bottle and a sting ampule from a cabinet. He poured a drink and handed it to Kempsey. He hefted the ampule in his palm, smiling. Kempsey drank the whiskey, still dazed, still exulting.
Free, he muttered. God bless him, free. You don't know what I've been through.
He drank again.
I still can't believe it. It's like a dream. Why don't you take off, man?
Kempsey choked and dropped the glass, staring at Foyle in horror.
Your face!
He exclaimed.
My God, your face! What happened to it?
You happened to it, you son of a bitch!
Foyle cried. He leaped up, his tiger face burning, and flung the ampule like a knife. It pierced Kempsey's neck and hung quivering. Kempsey toppled. Foyle accelerated, blurred to the body, picked it up in mid-fall, and carried it aft to the starboard stateroom. There were two main staterooms in the yawl, and Foyle had prepared both of them in advance. The starboard room had been stripped and turned into a surgery. Foyle strapped the body on the operating table, opened a case of surgical instruments, and began the delicate operation he had learned by hypno training that morning. An operation made possible only by his 5-to-1 acceleration. He cut through skin and fascia, sawed through the rib cage, exposed the heart, dissected it out, and connected veins and arteries to the intricate blood pump alongside the table. He started the pump. 20 seconds, objective time, had elapsed. He placed an oxygen mask over Kempsey's face and switched on the alternating suction and ructation of the oxygen pump. Foyle decelerated, checked Kempsey's temperature, shot an anti-shock series into his veins, and waited. Blood gurgled through the pump in Kempsey's body. After 5 minutes, Foyle removed the oxygen mask. The respiration reflex continued. Kempsey was without a heart, yet alive. Foyle sat down alongside the operating table and waited. The stigmata still showed on his face. Kempsey remained unconscious. Foyle waited. Kempsey awoke, screaming. Foyle leaped up, tightened the straps, and leaned over the heartless man.
Hello, Kempsey, he said.
Kempsey screamed.
Look at yourself, Kempsey. You're dead.
Kempsey fainted. Foyle brought him to with the oxygen mask.
Let me die, for God's sake.
What's the matter? Does it hurt? I died for 6 months, and I didn't whine.
Let me die.
In time, Kempsey. Your sympathetic block's been bypassed, but I'll let you die in time if you behave. You were aboard Vorga on September 16th, 2436?
For Christ's sake, let me die.
You were aboard Vorga?
Yes.
You passed a wreck out in space, wreck of the Nomad. She signaled for help and you passed her by, yes?
Yes.
Why?
Christ, oh Christ, help me.
Why?
Oh, Jesus.
I was aboard Nomad, Kempsey. Why did you leave me to rot?
Sweet Jesus, help me, Christ, deliver me.
I'll deliver you, Kempsey, if you answer questions. Why did you leave me to rot?
Couldn't pick you up.
Why not?
Ref's aboard.
Oh, I guessed right then. You were running refugees in from Callisto.
Yes.
How many?
600.
That's a lot. But you could have made room for one more. Why didn't you pick me up?
We were scuttling the refs.
What? Foyle cried.
Overboard. All of them. 600. Stripped them, took their clothes, money, jewels, baggage, put them through the airlock in batches. Christ! The clothes all over the ship. The shrieking and the... Jesus! If I could only forget. The naked women. Blue, busting wide open, spinning behind us. The clothes all over the ship. 600. Scuttled.
You son of a bitch. It was a racket. You took their money and never intended bringing them to Earth.
It was a racket.
And that's why you didn't pick me up.
Would have had to scuttle you anyway.
Who gave the order?
Captain.
Name?
Joyce. Lindsay Joyce.
Address?
Scopsy Colony Mars.
What? Foyle was thunderstruck. He's a Scopsy. You mean after hunting him for a year I can't touch him? Hurt him? Make him feel what I felt?
He turned away from the tortured man on the table, equally tortured himself by frustration.
A Scopsy. The one thing I never figured on. After preparing that port stateroom for him, what am I going to do? What in God's name am I going to do?
He roared in fury, the stigmata showing livid on his face. He was recalled by a desperate moan from Kempsey. He returned to the table and bent over the dissected body.
Let's get it straight for the last time. This Scopsy, Lindsay Joyce, gave the order to scuttle the refs?
Yes.
And to let me rot?
Yes, yes, yes. That's enough. Let me die.
Live, you pig man. Filthy, heartless bastard. Live without a heart. Live and suffer. I'll keep you alive forever, you...
A lurid flash of light caught Foyle's eye. He looked up. His burning image was peering through the large, square porthole of the stateroom. As he leaped to the porthole, the burning man disappeared. Foyle left the stateroom and darted forward to main controls, where the observation bubble gave him 270 degrees of vision. The burning man was nowhere in sight.
It's not real, he muttered. It couldn't be real. It's a sign, a good luck sign, a guardian angel. It saved me on the Spanish stairs. It's telling me to go ahead and find Lindsay Joyce.
He strapped himself into the pilot chair, ignited the yawl's jets, and slammed into full acceleration.
Lindsay Joyce, Scopsy Colony Mars, he thought as he was thrust back deep into the pneumatic chair. A Scopsy. Without senses, without pleasure, without pain. The ultimate and stoic escape. How am I going to punish him? Torture him? Put him in the port stateroom and make him feel what I felt aboard Nomad? Damnation. It's as though he's dead. He is dead. And I've got to figure how to beat a dead body and make it feel pain. To come so close to the end and have the door slammed in your face. The damnable frustration of revenge. Revenge is for dreams, never for reality.
An hour later, he released himself from the acceleration and his fury, unbuckled himself from the chair, and remembered Kempsey. He went aft to the surgery. The extreme acceleration of the takeoff had choked the blood pump enough to kill Kempsey. Suddenly, Foyle was overcome with a novel, passionate revulsion for himself. He fought it helplessly.
What's the matter, you? He whispered. Think of the 600 scuttled. Think of yourself. Are you turning into a white-livered cellar Christian, turning the other cheek and whining forgiveness? Olivia, what are you doing to me? Give me strength, not cowardice.
Nevertheless, he averted his eyes as he scuttled the body. Chapter 13. All persons known to be in the employ of 4 Mile of Ceres or associated with him in any capacity to be held for questioning. YY, Central Intelligence. All employees of this company to maintain strict watch for 1 4-mile of Ceres and report at once to local Mr. Presto. Pristine. All couriers will abandon present assignments and report for reassignment to foil case. Dagenham. A bank holiday will be declared immediately in the name of the war crisis to cut 4 Mile off from all funds. YY, Central Intelligence. Anyone making inquiries re SS Vorga to be taken to Castle Pristine for examination. Pristine. All ports and fields and inner planets to be alerted for arrival of 4 Mile. Quarantine and customs to check all landings. YY, Central Intelligence. Old St. Patrick's to be searched and watched. Dagenham. The files of Bonesse and Urg to be checked for names of officers and men of Vorga to anticipate, if possible, Foyle's next move. Pristine. War Crimes Commission to make up list of public enemies giving Foyle number one spot. YY, Central Intelligence. 1 million credit reward offered for information leading to apprehension of 4 Mile of Ceres, alias Gulliver Foyle, alias Gully Foyle, now at large in the inner planets. Priority. After 2 centuries of colonization, the air struggle on Mars was still so critical that the VL law, the Vegetative Lynch Law, was still in effect. It was a killing offense to endanger or destroy any plant vital to the transformation of Mars's carbon dioxide atmosphere into an oxygen atmosphere. Even blades of grass were sacred. There was no need to erect "keep off the grass" neons. The man who wandered off a path onto a lawn would be instantly shot. The woman who picked a flower would be killed without mercy. 2 centuries of sudden death had inspired a reverence for green growing things that almost amounted to a religion. Foyle remembered this as he raced up the center of the causeway leading to Mars Saint Michel. He had jaunted direct from the Syrtis airport to the Saint Michel stage at the foot of the causeway, which stretched for 1/4 mile through green fields to Mars Saint Michel. The rest of the distance had to be traversed on foot. Like the original Mont Saint-Michel on the French coast, Mars Saint-Michel was a majestic Gothic cathedral of spires and buttresses looming on a hill and yearning toward the sky. Ocean tides surrounded Mont Saint-Michel on Earth. Green tides of grass surrounded Mars Saint-Michel. Both were fortresses. Mont Saint-Michel had been a fortress of faith before organized religion was abolished. Mars Saint-Michel was a fortress of telepathy. Within it lived Mars's sole full telepath, Sigurd Magsman.
"Now these are the defenses protecting Sigurd Magsman," Foyle chanted halfway between hysteria and litany. "Firstly, the solar system. Secondly, martial law. Thirdly, Dagenham Pristine and Company. Fourthly, the fortress itself. Fifthly, the uniformed guards, attendants, servants, and admirers of the bearded sage we all know so well, Sigurd Magsman, selling his awesome powers for awesome prices." Foyle laughed immoderately. "But there's a sixthly that I know. Sigurd Magsman's Achilles heel. For I've paid 1 million credits to Sigurd III. Or was he 4?
He passed through the outer labyrinth of Mars Saint-Michel with his forged credentials and was tempted to bluff or proceed directly by commando action to an audience with the great man himself. But time was pressing, and his enemies were closing in, and he could not afford to satisfy his curiosity. Instead, he accelerated, blurred, and found a humble cottage set in a walled garden within the Mars Saint-Michel home farm. It had drab windows and a thatched roof, and might have been mistaken for a stable. Foyle slipped inside. The cottage was a nursery. 3 pleasant nannies sat motionless in rocking chairs, knitting poised in their frozen hands. The blur that was Foyle came up behind them and quietly stung them with ampules. Then he decelerated. He looked at the ancient child. the wizened, shriveled boy who was seated on the floor playing with electronic trains.
"Hello, Sigurd," Foyle said.
The child began to cry.
"Cry, baby. What are you afraid of? I'm not going to hurt you."
"You're a bad man with a bad face."
"I'm your friend, Sigurd."
"No, you're not. You want me to do bad things."
"I'm your friend. Look, I know all about those big hairy men who pretend to be you, but I won't tell. Read me and see."
"You're going to hurt him, and you want me to tell him."
"Who?"
"The captain, man. The Scott.
The child fumbled with a word, wailing louder.
"Go away. You're bad. Badness in your head and burning men's...
"Come here, Sigurd."
"No. Nanny. Nanny."
"Shut up, you little bastard."
Foyle grabbed the 70-year-old child and shook it.
"This is going to be a brand new experience for you, Sigurd. The first time you've ever been walloped into anything. Understand?"
The ancient child read him and howled.
"Shut up. We're going on a trip to the Scotsy colony. If you behave yourself and do what you're told, I'll bring you back safe and give you a lolly, or whatever the hell they bribe you with. If you don't behave, I'll beat the living daylights out of you."
"No, you won't. You won't. I'm Sigurd Marksman. I'm Sigurd the telepath. You wouldn't dare."
"Sonny, I'm Gully Foyle, solar enemy number one. I'm just a step away from the finish of a year-long hunt. I'm risking my neck because I need you to settle accounts with a son of a bitch who..." "Sonny, I'm Gully Foyle. There isn't anything I wouldn't dare."
The telepath began broadcasting terror with such an uproar that alarms sounded all over Mars Saint-Michel. Foyle took a firm grip on the ancient child, accelerated, and carried him out of the fortress. Then he jaunted.
"Urgent. Sigurd Marksman kidnapped by man tentatively identified as Gulliver Foyle, alias 4 Mile of Ceres, solar enemy number one. Destination tentatively fixed. Alert Commando Brigade. Inform Central Intelligence. Urgent."
The ancient Skoptsy sect of White Russia, believing that sex was the root of all evil, practiced an atrocious self-castration to extirpate the root. The modern Skoptsys, believing that sensation was the root of all evil, practiced an even more barbaric custom. Having entered the Skoptsy colony and paid a fortune for the privilege, the initiates submitted joyously to an operation that severed the sensory nervous system and lived out their days without sight, sound, speech, smell, taste, or touch. When they first entered the monastery, the initiates were shown elegant ivory cells in which it was intimated they would spend the remainder of their lives in rapt contemplation, lovingly tended. In actuality, the senseless creatures were packed in catacombs, where they sat on rough stone slabs and were fed and exercised once a day. For 23 out of 24 hours, they sat alone in the dark, untended, unguarded, unloved.
"The living dead," Foyle muttered.
He decelerated, put Sigurd Marksman down, and switched on the retinal light in his eyes, trying to pierce the womb gloom. It was midnight above ground. It was permanent midnight down in the catacombs. Sigurd Marksman was broadcasting terror and anguish with such a telepathic bray that Foyle was forced to shake the child again.
"Shut up," he whispered. "You can't wake these dead. Now find me Lindsay Joyce."
"They're sick. All sick. Like worms in their heads. Worms and sickness and..."
"Christ, don't I know it. Come on, let's get it over with. There's worse to come."
They went down the twisting labyrinth of the catacombs. The stone slabs shelved the walls from floor to ceiling. The Skoptsys, white as slugs, mute as corpses, motionless as Buddhas, filled the caverns with the odor of living death. The telepathic child wept and shrieked. Foyle never relaxed his relentless grip on him. He never relaxed the hunt.
"Johnson, Wright, Keeley, Graff, Nastro, Underwood. God, there's thousands here."
Foyle read off the bronze identification plates attached to the slabs.
"Reach out, Sigurd. Find Lindsay Joyce for me. We can't go over them name by name. Regal, Cone, Brady, Vincent..."
"What in the..." Foyle started back. One of the bone-white figures had cuffed his brow. It was swaying and writhing, its face twitching. All the white slugs on their shelves were squirming and writhing. Sigurd Magsman's constant telepathic broadcast of anguish and terror was reaching them and torturing them.
Shut up! Foyle snapped. Stop it! Find Lindsay Joyce and we'll get out of here. Reach out and find him.
Down there, Sigurd wept. Straight down there. 7, 8, 9 shelves down. I want to go home. I'm sick.
Foyle went pell-mell down the catacombs with Sigurd, reading off identification plates until at last he came to Lindsay Joyce. Bougainville. Venus. This was his enemy. The instigator of his death and the deaths of the 600 from Callisto. This was the enemy for whom he had planned vengeance and hunted for months. This was the enemy for whom he had prepared the agony of the port stateroom aboard his yawl. This was Vorga. It was a woman. Foyle was thunderstruck. In these days of the double standard, with women kept in purdah, there were many reported cases of women masquerading as men to enter the worlds closed to them, but he had never yet heard of a woman in the merchant marine masquerading her way to top officer rank.
This? He exclaimed furiously. This is Lindsay Joyce. Lindsay Joyce off the Vorga? Ask her.
I don't know what Vorga is.
Ask her.
But I don't... She was. She, like, gave orders.
Captain?
I don't like what's inside her. It's all sick and dark and hurts. I want to go home.
Ask her, was she captain of the Vorga?
Yes. Please, 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 don't make me go inside her anymore. It's twisty and hurts. I don't like her.
Tell her I'm the man she wouldn't pick up on September 16th, 2436. Tell her it's taken a long time, but I finally come to settle the account. Tell her I'm going to pay her back.
I don't understand. Don't understand.
Tell her I'm going to kill her, slow and hard. Tell her I've got a stateroom aboard my yawl, fitted up just like my locker aboard Nomad, where I rotted for 6 months. Where she ordered Vorga to leave me to die. Tell her she's going to rot and die just like me. Tell her.
Foyle shook the wizened child furiously.
Make her feel it. Don't let her get away by turning scopsy. Tell her I kill her filthy. Read me and tell her.
She didn't give that order.
What?
I can't understand her.
She didn't give the order to scuttle me?
I'm afraid to go in.
Go in, you little son of a bitch, or I'll take you apart. What does she mean?
The child wailed. The woman writhed. Foyle fumed.
Go in. Go in. Get it out of her. Jesus Christ, why does the only telepath on Mars have to be a child? Sigurd. Sigurd, listen to me. Ask her. Did she give the order to scuttle the refs?
No. No.
No, she didn't, or no, you won't?
She didn't.
Did she give the order to pass Nomad by?
She's twisty and sicky. Oh, please, Lenny, I want to go home. Want to go.
Did she give the order to pass Nomad by?
No.
She didn't?
No, take me home.
Ask her who did.
I want my nanny.
Ask her who could give her an order. She was captain aboard her own ship. Who could command her? Ask her.
I want my nanny.
Ask her.
No, 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 I'm afraid. She's sick. She's dark and black. She's bad. I don't understand her. I want my nanny. I want to go home.
The child was shrieking and shaking. Foyle was shouting. The echoes thundered as Foyle reached for the child in a rage. His eyes were blinded by brilliant light. The entire catacomb was illuminated by the burning man. Foyle's image stood before him, face hideous, clothes on fire, the blazing eyes fixed on the convulsing Scotsy that had been Lindsay Joyce. The burning man opened his tiger mouth. A grating sound emerged. It was like flaming laughter.
She hurts, he said.
Who are you?
Foyle whispered. The burning man winced.
Too bright, he said. Less light.
Foyle took a step forward. The burning man clapped hands over his ears in agony.
Too loud,
he cried.
Don't move so loud.
Are you my guardian angel?
You're blinding me.
Shh.
Suddenly he laughed again.
Listen to her. She's screaming, begging. She doesn't want to die. She doesn't want to be hurt. Listen to her.
Foyle trembled.
She's telling us who gave the order. Can't you hear? Listen with your eyes.
The burning man pointed a talon finger at the writhing Scopsy.
She says, Olivia.
What?
She says, Olivia. Olivia Prestine. Olivia Prestine. Olivia Prestine.
The burning man vanished. The catacombs were dark again. Colored lights and cacophonies whirled around Foyle. He gasped and staggered.
Blue jaunt, he muttered.
Olivia, no, not, never.
Olivia, I...
He felt a hand reach for his.
Jizz,
he croaked. He became aware that Sigurd Magsman was holding onto his hand and weeping. He picked the boy up.
I hurt,
Sigurd whimpered.
I hurt too, son.
Want to go home?
I'll take you home.
Still holding the boy in his arms, he blundered through the catacombs.
The living dead, he mumbled.
And then,
I've joined them.
He found the stone steps that led up from the depths to the monastery cloister above ground. He trudged up the steps, tasting death and desolation. There was bright light above him, and for a moment he imagined that dawn had come already. Then he realized that the cloister was brilliantly lit with artificial light. There was the tramp of shod feet and the low growl of commands. Halfway up the steps, Foyle stopped and mustered himself.
Sigurd, he whispered. Who's above us? Find out.
Soldiers,
the child answered.
Soldiers? What soldiers?
Commando soldiers.
Sigurd's crumpled face brightened.
They come for me, to take me home to Nanny. Here I am, here I am.
The telepathic clamor brought a shout from overhead. Foyle accelerated and blurred up the rest of the steps to the cloister. It was a square of Romanesque arches surrounding a green lawn. In the center of the lawn was a giant cedar of Lebanon. The flagged walks swarmed with commando search parties, and Foyle came face to face with his match. For an instant after they saw his blur whip up from the catacombs, they accelerated too, and all were on even terms. But Foyle had the boy. Shooting was impossible. Cradling Sigurd in his arms, he wove through the cloister like a broken field runner hurtling toward a goal. No one dared block him, for at plus five acceleration, a head-on collision between two bodies would be instantly fatal to both. Objectively, this breakneck skirmish looked like a five-second zigzag of lightning. Foyle broke out of the cloister, went through the main hall of the monastery, passed through the labyrinth, and reached the public jaunt stage outside the main gate. There he stopped, decelerated, and jaunted to the monastery airfield half a mile distant. The field, too, was ablaze with lights and swarming with commandos. Every anti-grav pit was occupied by a brigade ship. His own yawl was under guard. A fifth of a second after Foyle arrived at the field, the pursuers from the monastery jaunted in. He looked around desperately. He was surrounded by half a regiment of commandos, all under acceleration, all geared for lethal action, all his equal or better. The odds were impossible. And then the outer satellites altered the odds. Exactly 1 week after the saturation raid on Terra, they struck at Mars. Again the missiles came down on the midnight to dawn quadrant. Again the heavens twinkled with interceptions and detonations, and the horizon exploded great puffs of light while the ground shook. But this time there was a ghastly variation, for a brilliant nova burst overhead, flooding the night side of the planet with garish light. A swarm of fission heads had struck Mars's tiny satellite Phobos, instantly vaporizing it into a sunlet. The recognition lag of the commandos to this appalling attack gave Foyle his opportunity. He accelerated again and burst through them to his yawl. He stopped before the main hatch and saw the stunned guard party hesitate between a continuance of the old action and a response to the new. Foyle hurled Sigurd Mogsman up into the air like an ancient Scotsman tossing the caber. As the guard party rushed to catch the boy, Foyle dove through them into his yawl, slammed the hatch, and dogged it. Still under acceleration, never pausing to see if anyone was inside the yawl, he shot forward to controls, tripped the release lever, and as the yawl started to float up the anti-grav beam, threw on full 10G propulsion. He was not strapped into the pilot chair. The effect of the 10G drive on his accelerated and unprotected body was monstrous. A creeping force took hold of him and spilled him out of the chair. He inched back toward the rear wall of the control chamber like a sleepwalker. The wall appeared, to his accelerated senses, to approach him. He thrust out both arms, palms flat against the wall to brace himself. The sluggish power thrusting him back split his arms apart and forced him against the wall, gently at first, then harder and harder, until face, jaw, chest, and body were crushed against the metal. The mounting pressure became agonizing. He tried to trip the switchboard in his mouth with his tongue, but the propulsion crushing him against the wall made it impossible for him to move his distorted mouth. A burst of explosions, so far down the sound spectrum that they sounded like sodden rock slides, told him that the commando brigade was bombarding him with shots from below. As the yawl tore up into the blue-black of outer space, he began to scream in a bat screech before he mercifully lost consciousness. Chapter 14. Foyle awoke in darkness. He was decelerated, but the exhaustion of his body told him he had been under acceleration while he had been unconscious. Either his power pack had run out, or he inched a hand to the small of his back. The pack was gone. It had been removed. He explored with trembling fingers. He was in a bed. He listened to the murmur of ventilators and air conditioners and the click and buzz of servo mechanisms. He was aboard a ship. He was strapped to the bed. The ship was in free fall. Foyle unfastened himself, pressed his elbows against the mattress, and floated up. He drifted through the darkness, searching for a light switch or a call button. His hands brushed against a water carafe with raised letters on the glass. He read them with his fingertips. SS, he felt. V-O-R-G-A. Vorga! He cried out. The door of the stateroom opened. A figure drifted through the door, silhouetted against the light of a luxurious private lounge behind it.
"This time we picked you up," a voice said.
"Olivia?"
"Yes."
"Then it's true."
"Yes, Scully."
Foyle began to cry.
"You're still weak," Olivia Pristine said gently. "Come and lie down."
She urged him into the lounge and strapped him into a chaise longue. It was still warm from her body.
"You've been like this for 6 days. We never thought you'd live. Everything was drained out of you before the surgeon found that battery on your back."
"Where is it?"
he croaked.
"You can have it whenever you want it. Don't fret, my dear."
He looked at her for a long moment. His snow maiden. His beloved ice princess. The white satin skin, the blind coral eyes, an exquisite coral mouth. She touched his moist eyelids with a scented handkerchief.
"I love you," he said.
"Shh. I know, Gully.
You've known all about me. For how long?"
"I knew Gully Foyle, the spaceman off the Nomad, was my enemy from the beginning. I never knew you were 4 Mile until we met. Ah, if only I'd known before, how much would have been saved."
"You knew, and you've been laughing at me."
"No."
"Standing by and shaking with laughter."
"Standing by and loving you. No, don't interrupt. I'm trying to be rational, and it's not easy."
A flush cascaded across the marble face.
"I'm not playing with you now. I betrayed you to my father. I did. self-defense, I thought. Now that I've met him at last, I can see he's too dangerous. An hour later, I knew it was a mistake because I realized I was in love with you. I'm paying for it now. You need never have known.
You expect me to believe that?
Then why am I here?
She trembled slightly.
Why did I follow you? That bombing was ghastly. You'd have been dead in another minute when we picked you up. Your yawl was a wreck.
Where are we now?
What difference does it make?
I'm stalling for time.
Time for what?
Not for time. I'm stalling for courage.
We're orbiting Earth.
How did you follow me?
I knew you'd be after Lindsay Joyce. I took over one of my father's ships. It happened to be Vorga again.
Does he know?
He never knows. I live my own private life.
He could not take his eyes off her, and yet it hurt him to look at her. He was yearning and hating, yearning for the reality to be undone, hating the truth for what it was. He discovered that he was stroking her handkerchief with tremulous fingers.
I love you, Olivia.
I love you, Gully, my enemy.
For God's sake, he burst out. Why did you do it? You were aboard Vorga running the ref racket. You gave the order to scuttle them. You gave the order to pass me by. Why? Why?
What? She lashed back. Are you demanding apologies?
I'm demanding an explanation.
You'll get none from me.
Blood and money, your father said he was right. Oh, bitch, bitch, bitch.
Blood and money, yes. And unashamed.
I'm drowning, Olivia. Throw me a lifeline.
Then drown. Nobody ever saved me. No. No. This is wrong, all wrong. Wait, my dear, wait.
She composed herself and began speaking very tenderly.
I could lie, Gully dear, and make you believe it. But I'm going to be honest. There's a simple explanation. I live my own private life. We all do. You do.
What's yours?
No different from yours. From the rest of the world? I cheat, I lie, I destroy. Like all of us. I'm criminal. Like all of us.
Why? For money? You don't need money.
No.
For control? Power?
Not for power.
Then why?
She took a deep breath, as though this truth was the first truth and was crucifying her.
For hatred. To pay you back, all of you.
For what?
For being blind, she said in a smoldering voice. For being cheated. For being helpless. They should have killed me when I was born. Do you know what it's like to be blind? To receive life secondhand? To be dependent, begging, crippled? Bring them down to your level, I told my secret life. If you're blind, make them blinder. If you're helpless, cripple them. Pay them back. All of them.
Olivia, you're insane.
And you?
I'm in love with a monster.
We're a pair of monsters.
No.
No, not you, she flared. What have you been doing but paying the world back like me? What's your revenge but settling your own private account with bad luck? Who wouldn't call you a crazy monster? I tell you, we're a pair, Gully. We couldn't help falling in love.
He was stunned by the truth of what she said. He tried on the shroud of her revelation, and it fit, clung tighter than the tiger mask tattooed on his face.
It's true, he said slowly. I'm no better than you. Worse. But before God, I never murdered 600.
You're murdering 6 million.
What?
Perhaps more. You've got something they need to end the war, and you're holding out.
You mean Pyre?
Yes.
What is it, this bringer of peace, this 20 pounds of miracle that they're fighting for?
I don't know. But I know they need it. And I don't care. Yes, I'm being honest now. I don't care. Let millions be murdered. It makes no difference to us. Not to us, Gully, because we stand apart. We stand apart and shape our own world. We're the strong.
We're the damned.
We're the blessed. We've found each other.
Suddenly, she laughed and held out her arms.
I'm arguing when there's no need for words. Come to me, my love. Wherever you are, come to me.
He touched her, and then put his arms around her. He found her mouth and devoured her, but he was forced to release her.
What is it, Gully, darling?
I'm not a child anymore, he said wearily. I've learned to understand that nothing is simple. There's never a simple answer. You can love someone and loathe them.
Can you, Gully?
And you're making me loathe myself.
No, my dear.
I've been a tiger all my life. I trained myself, educated myself, pulled myself up by my stripes to make me a stronger tiger with a longer claw and a sharper tooth, quick and deadly.
And you are. You are the deadliest.
No, I'm not. I went too far. I went beyond simplicity. I turned myself into a thinking creature. I look through your blind eyes, my love, whom I loathe, and I see myself. The tiger's gone.
There's no place for the tiger to go. You're trapped, Gully, by Dagenham, intelligence, my father, the world.
I know.
But you're safe with me. We're safe together, the pair of us. They'll never dream of looking for you near me. We can plan together, fight together, destroy them together.
No. Not together.
What is it? She flared again. Are you still hunting me? Is that what's wrong? Do you still want revenge? Then take it. Here I am. Go ahead. Destroy me.
No. Destruction's finished for me.
Ah. I know what it is.
She became tender again in an instant.
It's your face, poor darling. You're ashamed of your tiger face, but I love it. You burn so brightly for me. You burn through the blindness. Believe me.
My God, what a pair of loathsome freaks we are.
What's happened to you?
She demanded. She broke away from him, her coral eyes glittering.
Where's the man who watched the raid with me? Where's the unashamed savage who...
Gone, Olivia. You've lost him. We both have.
Gully!
He's lost.
But why? What have I done?
You don't understand, Olivia.
Where are you?
She reached out, touched him, and then clung to him.
Listen to me, darling. You're tired. You're exhausted, that's all. Nothing is lost.
The words tumbled out of her.
You're right, of course you're right. We've been bad, both of us, loathsome. But all that's gone now. Nothing is lost. We were wicked because we were alone and unhappy. But we found each other. We can save each other. Be my love, darling, always, forever. I've looked for you so long, waited and hoped and prayed.
No, you're lying, Olivia, and you know it.
For God's sake, Gully.
Put Vorga down, Olivia.
Land?
Yes.
On Terra?
Yes.
What are you going to do? You're insane. They're hunting you, waiting for you, watching. What are you going to do?
Do you think this is easy for me? He said. I'm doing what I have to do. I'm still driven. No man ever escapes from that. But there's a different compulsion in the saddle. And the spurs hurt, damn it. They hurt like hell.
He stifled his anger and controlled himself. He took her hands and kissed her palms.
It's all finished, Olivia, he said gently. But I love you. Always. Forever.
I'll sum it up, Dagenham rapped. We were bombed the night we found Foyle. We lost him on the moon and found him a week later on Mars. We were bombed again. We lost him again. He's been lost for a week. Another bombing's due. Which one of the inner planets? Venus? The moon? Terra again? Who knows? But we all know this. One more raid without retaliation and we're lost. He glanced around the table. against the ivory and gold background of the star chamber of Castle Christine. His face, all three faces, looked strained. Yang Yovel slitted his eyes in a frown. Christine compressed his thin lips. "And we know this, too," Dagenham continued. "We can't retaliate without Pyre, and we can't locate the Pyre without Foyle."
"My instructions were," Christine interposed, "that Pyre was not to be mentioned in public."
"In the first place, this is not public," Dagenham snapped. "It's a private information pool. In the second place, we've gone beyond property rights. We're discussing survival, and we've all got equal rights in that." "Yes, Jiz?"
Gisbella McQueen had jaunted into the star chamber, looking intent and furious. "Still no sign of Foyle."
"Old St. Pat still being watched?"
"Yes."
"Commando brigades report in for Mars yet?"
"No."
"That's my business and most secret," Yang Yovel objected mildly.
"You've got as few secrets from me as I have from you," Dagenham grinned mirthlessly. "See if you can beat Central Intelligence back here with that report, Jez." "Go."
She disappeared.
"About property rights," Yang Yovel murmured, "may I suggest to Pristine that Central Intelligence will guarantee full payment to him for his right title and interest in Pyre?"
"Don't coddle him, Yovel."
"This conference is being recorded," Pristine said coldly. "The captain's offer is now on file."
He turned his basilisk face to Dagenham.
"You are in my employ, Mr. Dagenham. Please control your references to myself."
"And to your property?" Dagenham inquired with a deadly smile. "You and your damned property. All of you and all of your damned property have put us in this hole. The system's on the edge of total annihilation for the sake of your property. I'm not exaggerating. It will be a shooting war to end all wars if we can't stop it."
"We can always surrender," Christine answered.
"No," Yang Yovel said. "That's already been discussed and discarded at HQ. We know the post-victory plans of the outer satellites. They involve total exploitation of the inner planets. We're to be gutted and worked until nothing's left. Surrender would be as disastrous as defeat."
"But not for Pristine," Dagenham added.
"Shall we say, present company excluded," Yang Yovel replied gracefully.
"All right, Pristine," Dagenham swiveled in his chair. "Give."
"I beg your pardon, sir."
"Let's hear all about Pyre. I've got an idea how we can bring Foyle out into the open and locate the stuff, but I've got to know all about it first. Make your contribution."
"No,"
Christine answered.
"Now what?"
"I have decided to withdraw from this information pool. I will reveal nothing about Pyre."
"For God's sake, Christine, are you insane? What's got into you? Are you fighting Regis Sheffield's Liberal Party again?"
"That's quite simple, Dagenham," Yang Yovel interposed. "My information about the surrender-defeat situation has shown Pristine a way to better his position. No doubt he intends negotiating a sale to the enemy in return for property advantages."
"Can nothing move you?" Dagenham asked Pristine scornfully. "Can nothing touch you? Are you all property and nothing else?"
"Go away, Jez. The whole thing's fallen apart."
Gisbella had jaunted into the star chamber again. "Commando brigades reported," she said. "We know what happened to Foyle."
"What?"
"Pristine's got him."
"What?"
Both Dagenham and Yang Yovel started to their feet. "He left Mars in a private yawl, was shot up, and was observed being picked up by the Pristine SS Vorga."
"Damn you, Pristine," Dagenham snapped. "So that's why you've been..."
"Wait," Yang Yovel commanded. "It's news to him, too, Dagenham. Look at him."
Pristine's handsome face had gone the color of ashes. He tried to rise and fell back stiffly in his chair.
"Olivia," he whispered. "With him. That scum."
"Pristine?"
"My daughter, gentlemen, has for some time been engaged in certain activities. The family vice. Blood and... I have managed to close my eyes to it. Had almost convinced myself that I was mistaken. But Foyle! Dirt! Filth!"
He must be destroyed!
Pristine's voice soared alarmingly. His head twisted back like a hanged man's, and his body began to shudder.
What in the...
Epilepsy, Yang Yovel said. He pulled Pristine out of the chair onto the floor.
A spoon, Miss McQueen, quick!
He levered Pristine's teeth open and placed a spoon between them to protect the tongue. As suddenly as it had begun, the seizure was over. The shuddering stopped. Pristine opened his eyes.
Pity Ma, Yang Yovel murmured, withdrawing the spoon. But he'll be dazed for a while.
Suddenly, Pristine began speaking in a low monotone.
Pyre is a pyrophoric alloy. A pyrophore is a metal which emits sparks when scraped or struck. Pyre emits energy, which is why E, the energy symbol, was added to the prefix PYR. Pyre is a solid solution of transplutonian isotopes, releasing thermonuclear energy on the order of stellar Phoenix action. Its discoverer was of the opinion that he had produced the equivalent of the primordial protomatter which exploded into the universe.
My God!
Gisbella exclaimed. Degadam silenced her with a gesture and bent over Pristine.
How is it brought to critical mass, Pristine? How is the energy released?
As the original energy was generated in the beginning of time, Pristine droned, through will and idea.
I'm convinced he's a subtle Christian,
Dingenham muttered to Yang Yovel. He raised his voice.
Will you explain, Pristine?
Through will and idea, Pristine repeated. Pyre can only be exploded by psychokinesis. Its energy can only be released by thought. It must be willed to explode, and the thought directed at it. That is the only way.
There's no key, no formula.
No, only will and idea are necessary.
The glazed eyes closed.
God in heaven,
Dagenham mopped his brow.
Will this give the outer satellites pause, Yovel?
It'll give us all pause.
It's the road to hell,
Gisbella said.
Then let's find it and get off the road. Here's my idea, Yovel. Foyle was tinkering with that hell brew in his lab in Old St. Pat's, trying to analyze it.
I told you that in strict confidence,
Gisbella said furiously.
I'm sorry, dear. We're past honor and the decencies. Now look, Yovel, there must be some fragments of the stuff lying about, as dust, in solution, in precipitates. We've got to detonate those fragments and blow the hell out of Foyle Circus.
Why?
To bring him running. He must have the bulk of the pyre hidden there somewhere. He'll come to salvage it.
What if it blows up, too?
It can't, not inside an inert lead isotope safe.
Maybe it's not all inside.
Jiz says it is. At least so Foyle reported.
Leave me out of this, Gisbella said.
Anyway, we'll have to gamble.
Gamble? Yang Yovel exclaimed. On a Phoenix action? You'll gamble the solar system into a brand new nova.
What else can we do? Pick any other road, and it's the road to destruction, too. Have we got any choice?
We can wait,
Gisbella said.
For what? For Foyle to blow us up himself with his tinkering?
We can warn him.
We don't know where he is.
We can find him.
How soon? Won't that be a gamble, too? And what about that stuff lying around waiting for someone to think it into energy? Suppose a jack-jaunter gets in and cracks the safe, looking for goodies. And then we don't just have dust waiting for an accidental thought, but 20 pounds.
Gisbella turned pale. Dagenham turned to the intelligence man.
You make the decision, Yovel. Do we try it my way, or do we wait?
Yang Yovel sighed.
I was afraid of this, he said.
Damn all scientists. I'll have to make my decision for a reason you don't know, Dagenham. The outer satellites are onto this, too. We've got reason to believe that they've got agents looking for Foyle in the worst way. If we wait, they may pick him up before us. In fact, they may have him now. So your decision is the blow-up. Let's bring Foyle running if we can.
No,
Gisbella cried.
How?
Dagenham asked, ignoring her.
Oh, I've got just the one for the job. A one-way telepath named Robin Wensbury.
When?
At once. We'll clear the entire neighborhood. We'll get full news coverage and do a full broadcast. If Foyle's anywhere in the inner planets, he'll hear about it.
Not about it,
Gisbella said in despair.
He'll hear it. It'll be the last thing any of us hear.
Will and idea, Pristine whispered.
As always, when he returned from a stormy civil court session in Leningrad, Regis Sheffield was pleased and complacent, rather like a cocky prize fighter who's won a tough fight. He stopped off at Bleckmann's in Berlin for a drink and some war talk, had a second and more war talk and a legal hangout on the Quai d'Orsay, and a third session in the Skin and Bones opposite Temple Bar. By the time he arrived in his New York office, he was pleasantly illuminated. As he strode through the clattering corridors and outer rooms, he was greeted by his secretary with a handful of memo beads.
"Knocked Jargo Danchenko for a loop," Sheffield reported triumphantly. "Judgment and full damages. Old D.D.'s sores a boil. This makes the score 11-5, my favor."
He took the beads, juggled them, and then began tossing them into unlikely receptacles all over the office, including the open mouth of a gaping clerk.
"Really, Mr. Sheffield, have you been drinking?"
"No more work today. The war news is too damned gloomy. Have to do something to stay cheerful. What say we brawl in the streets?
Mr. Sheffield.
Anything waiting for me that can't wait another day?
There's a gentleman in your office."
"He made you let him get that far?" Sheffield looked impressed. "Who is he? God or somebody?"
"He won't give his name. He gave me this."
The secretary handed Sheffield a sealed envelope. On it was scrawled, "Urgent." Sheffield tore it open, his blunt features crinkling with curiosity. Then his eyes widened. Inside the envelope were two 50,000 credit notes. Sheffield turned without a word and burst into his private office. Foyle arose from his chair.
"These are genuine," Sheffield blurted.
"To the best of my knowledge."
"Exactly 20 of these notes were minted last year. All are on deposit in Terran treasuries. How did you get hold of these two?"
"Mr. Sheffield?"
"Who else? How did you get hold of these notes?"
"Bribery."
"Why?"
"I thought at the time that it might be convenient to have them available."
"For what? More bribery?"
"If legal fees are bribery."
"I set my own fees," Sheffield said. He tossed the notes back to Foyle. "You can produce them again if I decide to take your case and if I decide I've been worth that to you. What's your problem?"
"Criminal."
"Don't be too specific yet."
"And?" "I want to give myself up."
"To the police?"
"Yes."
"For what crime?"
"Crimes."
"Name two."
"Robbery and rape."
"Name two more."
"Blackmail and murder."
"Any other items?"
"Treason and genocide."
"Does that exhaust your catalog?"
"I think so. We may be able to unveil a few more when we get specific."
"Been busy, haven't you? Either you're the prince of villains or insane."
"I've been both, Mr. Sheffield."
"Why do you want to give yourself up?"
"I've come to my senses," Foyle answered bitterly.
"I don't mean that. A criminal never surrenders while he's ahead. You're obviously ahead. What's the reason?"
"The most damnable thing that ever happened to a man. I picked up a rare disease called conscience."
Sheffield snorted.
"That can often turn fatal."
"It is fatal. I've realized that I've been behaving like an animal."
"And now you want to purge yourself?"
"No, it isn't that simple," Foyle said grimly. "That's why I've come to you, for major surgery. The man who upsets the morphology of society is a cancer. The man who gives his own decisions priority over society is a criminal. But there are chain reactions. Purging yourself with punishment isn't enough. Everything's got to be set right. I wish to God everything could be cured just by sending me back to Jouffre Martel or shooting me
back,"
Sheffield cut in keenly.
"Shall I be specific?"
"Not yet. Go on. You sound as though you've got ethical growing pains."
"That's it, exactly."
Foyle paced in agitation, crumpling the banknotes with nervous fingers.
"This is one hell of a mess, Sheffield. There's a girl that's got to pay for a vicious, rotten crime. The fact that I love her... No, never mind that. She has a cancer that's got to be cut out, like me, which means I'll have to add informing to my catalog. The fact that I'm giving myself up, too, doesn't make any difference."
"What is all this mishmash?"
Foyle turned on Sheffield.
One of the New Year's bombs has just walked into your office, and it's saying, put it all right. Put me together again and send me home. Put together the city I flattened and the people I shattered. That's what I want to hire you for. I don't know how most criminals feel, but
sensible, matter-of-fact, like good businessmen who've had bad luck, Sheffield answered promptly. That's the usual attitude of the professional criminal. It's obvious you're an amateur, if you're a criminal at all. My dear sir, do be sensible. You come here, extravagantly accusing yourself of robbery, rape, murder, genocide, treason, and God knows what else. Do you expect me to take you seriously?
Bunny, Sheffield's assistant, jaunted into the private office.
Chief, he shouted in excitement, something brand new's turned up. A leck jaunt. Two society kids bribed a C-class tartar... Oops, sorry. Didn't realize you had...
Bunny broke off and stared.
4 Mile,
he exclaimed.
What? Who? Sheffield demanded.
Don't you know him, Chief? Bunny stammered. That's 4 Mile of series. Gully Foyle.
More than a year ago, Regis Sheffield had been hypnotically fulminated and triggered for this moment. His body had been prepared to respond without thought, and the response was lightning. Sheffield struck Foyle in half a second, temple, throat, and groin. It had been decided not to depend on weapons, since none might be available. Foyle fell. Sheffield turned on Bunny and battered him back across the office. Then he spat into his palm. It had been decided not to depend on drugs, since drugs might not be available. Sheffield's salivary glands had been prepared to respond with an anaphylaxis secretion to the stimulus. He ripped open Foyle's sleeve, dug a nail deep into the hollow of Foyle's elbow, and slashed. He pressed his spittle into the ragged cut and pinched the skin together. A strange cry was torn from Foyle's lips. The tattooing showed livid on his face. Before the stunned law assistant could make a move, Sheffield swung Foyle up to his shoulders and jaunted. He arrived in the middle of the 4 Mile circus in Old St. Pat's. It was a daring but calculated move. This was the last place he would be expected to go, and the first place where he might expect to locate the pyre. He was prepared to deal with anyone he might meet in the cathedral, but the interior of the circus was empty. The vacant tents ballooning up in the nave looked tattered. They had already been looted. Sheffield plunged into the first he saw. It was 4 Mile's traveling library, filled with hundreds of books and thousands of glittering novel beads. The jack-jotters were not interested in literature. Sheffield threw Foyle down on the floor. Only then did he take a gun from his pocket. Foyle's eyelids fluttered. His eyes opened.
You're drugged, Sheffield said rapidly. Don't try to jaunt, and don't move. I'm warning you. I'm prepared for anything.
Dazedly, Foyle tried to rise. Sheffield instantly fired and seared his shoulder. Foyle was slammed back against the stone flooring. He was numbed and bewildered. There was a roaring in his ears and a poison coursing through his blood.
I'm warning you, Sheffield repeated. I'm prepared for anything.
What do you want?
Foyle whispered. 2 things. 20 pounds of pyre and you. You, most of all.
You lunatic! You damned maniac! I came into your office to give it up! Hand it over!
To the O.S.?
To the what?
The outer satellites. Shall I spell it for you?
No, Foyle muttered. I might have known. The Patriot Sheffield, an O.S. agent. I should have known. I'm a fool.
You're the most valuable fool in the world, Foyle. We want you even more than the pyre. That's an unknown to us, but we know what you are.
What are you talking about?
My God, you don't know, do you? You still don't know. You haven't an inkling.
Of what?
Listen to me, Sheffield said in a pounding voice. I'm taking you back 2 years to Nomad, understand? Back to the death of the Nomad. One of our raiders finished her off, and they found you aboard the wreck, the last man alive.
So an O.S. ship did blast Nomad.
Yes, you don't remember?
I don't remember anything about that. I never could.
I'm telling you why. The raider got a clever idea. They'd turn you into a decoy. A sitting duck, understand? You were half dead, but they took you aboard and patched you up. They put you into a spacesuit and cast you adrift with your microwave on. You were broadcasting distress signals and mumbling for help on every wave band. The idea was they'd lurk nearby and pick off the IP ships that came to rescue you. Foyle began to laugh.
I'm getting up,
he said recklessly.
Shoot again, you son of a bitch, but I'm getting up.
He struggled to his feet, clutching his shoulder.
So Vorga shouldn't have picked me up anyway,
Foyle laughed.
I was a decoy. Nobody should have come near me. I was a shill, a lure, death bait. Isn't that the final irony? Nomad didn't have any right to be rescued in the first place. I didn't have any right to revenge.
You still don't understand, Sheffield pounded. They were nowhere near Nomad when they set you adrift. They were 600,000 miles from Nomad.
600,000?
Nomad was too far out of the shipping lanes. They wanted you to drift where ships would pass. They took you 600,000 miles sunward and set you adrift. They put you through the airlock and backed off, watching you drift. Your suit lights were blinking and you were moaning for help on the microwave. Then you disappeared.
Disappeared?
You were gone. No more lights, no more broadcast. They came back to check. You were gone without a trace. And the next thing we learned, you got back aboard Nomad.
Impossible.
Man, you space-jaunted, Sheffield said savagely. You were patched and delirious, but you space-jaunted. You space-jaunted 600,000 miles through the void back to the wreck of the Nomad. You did something that's never been done before. God knows how. You don't even know yourself, but we're going to find out. I'm taking you out to the satellites with me, and we'll get that secret out of you if we have to tear it out. He took Foyle's throat in his powerful hand and hefted the gun in the other. But first I want the pyre. You'll produce it, Foyle. Don't think you won't. He lashed Foyle across the forehead with the gun. I'll do anything to get it. Don't think I won't. He smashed Foyle again, coldly, efficiently. If you're looking for a purge, man, you've found it. Bunny leaped off the public jaunt stage at Five Points and streaked into the main entrance of Central Intelligence's New York office like a frightened rabbit. He shot past the outermost guard cordon, through the protective labyrinth, and into the inner offices. He acquired a train of excited pursuers and found himself face to face with the more seasoned guards who had calmly jaunted to positions ahead of him and were waiting. Bunny began to shout, Yovel! 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 Still running, he dodged around desks, kicked over chairs, and created an incredible uproar. He continued his yelling, Yovel! 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 Just before they were about to put him out of his misery, Yang Yovel appeared. What's all this? He snapped. I gave orders that Miss Winsbury was to have absolute quiet.
Yovel!
Bunny shouted.
Who's that?
Sheffield's assistant.
What? Bunny?
Foyle!
Bunny howled.
Gully Foyle!
Yang Yovel covered the 50 feet between them in exactly 1.66 seconds.
What about Foyle?
Sheffield's got him,
Bunny gasped.
Sheffield? When?
Half an hour ago.
Why didn't he bring him here?
He abducted him. I think Sheffield's an OS agent.
Why didn't you come at once?
Sheffield jaunted with Foyle, knocked him stiff and disappeared. I went looking, all over, took a chance. Must have made 50 jaunts in 20 minutes.
Amateur,
Yang Yovel exclaimed in exasperation.
Why didn't you leave that to the pros?
Found him.
You found them? Where?
Old St. Pat's. Sheffield's after the...
But Yang Yovel had turned on his heel and was tearing back up the corridor, shouting,
Robin! Robin, stop! Stop!
And then their ears were bruised by the bellow of thunder. Chapter 15. Like widening rings in a pond, the will and the idea spread, searching out, touching and tripping the delicate subatomic trigger of pyre. The thought found particles, dust, smoke, vapor, motes, molecules. The will and the idea transformed them all. In Sicily, where Dottore Franco Torre,
had worked for an exhausting month attempting to unlock the secret of one slug of pyre. The residues and the precipitates had been dumped down a drain which led to the sea. For many months, the Mediterranean currents had drifted these residues across the sea bottom. In an instant, a humpbacked mound of water towering 50 feet high traced the courses northeast to Sardinia and southwest to Tripoli. In a microsecond, the surface of the Mediterranean was raised into the twisted casting of a giant earthworm that wound around the islands of Pantelleria, Lampedusa, Linosa, and Malta. Some of the residues had been burned off, had gone up the chimney with smoke and vapor to drift for hundreds of miles before settling. These minute particles showed where they had finally settled in Morocco, Algeria, Libya, and Greece, with blinding pinpoint explosions of incredible minuteness and intensity. And some motes, still drifting in their stratosphere, revealed their presence with brilliant gleams like daylight stars. In Texas, where Professor John Mantley had had the same baffling experience with pyre, most of the residues had gone down the shaft of an exhausted oil well, which was also used to accommodate radioactive wastes. A deep water table had absorbed much of the matter and spread it slowly over an area of some 10 square miles. 10 square miles of Texas flats shook themselves into corduroy. A vast, untapped deposit of natural gas at last found a vent and came shrieking up to the surface, where sparks from flying stones ignited it into a roaring torch 200 feet high. A milligram of pyre, deposited on a disk of filter paper, long since discarded, forgotten, rounded up in a waste paper drive and at last pulped into a mold for type metal, destroyed the entire late-night edition of the Glasgow Observer. A fragment of pyre spattered on a lab smock, long since converted into rag paper, destroyed a thank-you note written by Lady Shrapnel, and destroyed an additional ton of first-class mail in the process. A shirt cuff, inadvertently dipped into an acid solution of pyre, long abandoned along with the shirt, and now worn under his mink suit by a jack-jaunter, blasted off the wrist and hand of the jack-jaunter in one fiery amputation. A decimilligram of pyre, still adhering to a former evaporation crystal now in use as an ashtray, kindled a fire that scorched the office of one baker, dealer in freaks and purveyor of monsters. Across the length and breadth of the planet were isolated explosions, chains of explosions, traceries of fire, pinpoints of fire, meteor flares in the sky, great craters and narrow channels plowed in the earth, exploded in the earth, vomited forth from the earth. In Old St. Pat's, nearly a tenth of a gram of pyre was exposed in 4 Mile's laboratory. The rest was sealed in its inert lead isotope safe, protected from accidental and intentional psychokinetic ignition. The blinding blast of energy generated from that tenth of a gram blew out the walls and split the floors as though an internal earthquake had convulsed the building. The buttresses held the pillars for a split second and then crumbled. Down came towers, spires, pillars, buttresses, and roof in a thundering avalanche to hesitate above the yawning crater of the floor in a tangled, precarious equilibrium. A breath of wind, a distant vibration, and the collapse would continue until the crater was filled solid with pulverized rubble. The star-like heat of the explosion ignited 100 fires and melted the ancient thick copper of the collapsed roof. If a milligram more of pyre had been exposed to detonation, the heat would have been intense enough to vaporize the metal immediately. Instead, it glowed white and began to flow. It streamed off the wreckage of the crumbled roof and began searching its way downward through the jumbled stone, iron, wood, and glass, like some monstrous molten mold creeping through a tangled web. Dagenham and Yang Yovel arrived almost simultaneously. A moment later, Robin Winsbury appeared, and then Gisbella McQueen. A dozen intelligence operatives and 6 Dagenham couriers arrived, along with Pristine's jaunt watch and the police. They formed a cordon around the blazing block, but there were very few spectators. After the shock of the New Year's Eve raid, that single explosion had frightened half New York into another wild jaunt for safety. The uproar of the fire was frightful, and the massive grind of tons of wreckage in uneasy balance was ominous. Everyone was forced to shout, and yet was fearful of the vibrations.
Yang-Yovel bawled the news about Foyle and Sheffield into Dagenham's ear. Dagenham nodded and displayed his deadly smile.
"We'll have to go in," he shouted.
"Fire suits,"
Yang-Yovel shouted. He disappeared and reappeared with a pair of white disaster crew fire suits. At the sight of these, Robin and Gisbella began shouting hysterical objections. The two men ignored them, wriggled into the inert isomer armor, and inched into the inferno. Within Old St. Pat's, it was as though a monstrous hand had churned a logjam of wood, stone, and metal. Through every interstice crawled tongues of molten copper, slowly working downward, igniting wood, crumbling stone, shattering glass. Where the copper flowed, it merely glowed, but where it poured, it spattered dazzling droplets of white-hot metal. Beneath the log jam yawned a black crater where formerly the floor of the cathedral had been. The explosion had split the flagstone asunder, revealing the cellars, sub-cellars, and vaults deep below the building. These, too, were filled with a snarl of stones, beams, pipes, wire, the remnants of the four-mile circus tents, all fitfully lit small fires. Then the first of the copper dripped down into the crater and illuminated it with a brilliant molten splash. Dagenham pounded Yang-Yovel's shoulder to attract his attention and pointed. Halfway down the crater, in the midst of the tangle, lay the body of Regis Sheffield, drawn and quartered by the explosion. Yang-Yovel pounded Dagenham's shoulder and pointed. Almost at the bottom of the crater lay Gully Foyle, and as the blazing spatter of molten copper illuminated him, they saw him move. The two men at once turned and crawled out of the cathedral for a conference.
"He's alive.
How's it possible?"
"I can guess. Did you see the shreds of tent wadded near him? It must have been a freak explosion up at the other end of the cathedral, and the tents in between cushioned Foyle. Then he dropped through the floor before anything else could hit him."
"I'll buy that. We've got to get him out. He's the only man who knows where the pyre is."
"Could it still be here, unexploded?"
"If it's in the ILI safe, yes. That stuff is inert to anything. Never mind that now. How are we going to get him out?"
"Well, we can't work down from above."
"Why not?"
"Isn't it obvious? One false step and the whole mess will collapse."
"Did you see that copper flowing down?"
"God, yes."
"Well, if we don't get him out in 10 minutes, he'll be at the bottom of a pool of molten copper."
"What can we do?"
"I've got a long shot."
"What?"
"The cellars of the old RCA buildings across the street are as deep as St. Pat's."
"And?"
"We'll go down and try to hole through. Maybe we can pull Foyle out from the bottom."
A squad broke into the ancient RCA buildings, abandoned and sealed up for two generations. They went down into the cellar arcades, crumbling museums of the retail stores of centuries past. They located the ancient elevator shafts and dropped through them into the sub-cellars filled with electric installations, heat plants, and refrigeration systems. They went down into the sump cellars, waist-deep in water from the streams of prehistoric Manhattan Island, streams that still flowed beneath the streets that covered them. As they waded through the sump cellars bearing east-northeast to bring up opposite the St. Pat's vaults, they suddenly discovered that the pitch dark was illuminated by a fiery flickering up ahead. Dagenham shouted and flung himself forward. The explosion that had opened the sub-cellars of St. Pat's had split the septum between its vaults and those of the RCA buildings. Through a jagged rent in stone and earth, they could peer into the bottom of the inferno. 50 feet inside was Foyle, trapped in a labyrinth of twisted beams, stones, pipe, metal, and wire. He was illuminated by a roaring glow from above him and fitful flames around him. His clothes were on fire and the tattooing was livid on his face. He moved feebly, like a bewildered animal in a maze.
"My God," Yang-Yovel exclaimed. "The burning man."
"What?"
"The burning man I saw on the Spanish stairs." "Never mind that now. What can we do?"
"Go in, of course." A brilliant white gob of copper suddenly oozed down close to Foyle and splashed 10 feet below him. It was followed by a second, a third, a slow, steady stream. A pool began to form. Dagenham and Yang-Yovel sealed the faceplates of their armor and crawled through the break in the septum. After 3 minutes of agonized struggling, they realized that they could not get through the labyrinth to Foyle. It was locked to the outside, but not from the inside. Dagenham and Yang-Yovel backed up to confer.
We can't get to him, Dagenham shouted. But he can get out.
How? He can't jaunt, obviously, or he wouldn't be there.
No, he can climb. Look, he goes left, then up, reverses, makes a turn along that beam, slides under it, and pushes through that tangle of wire. The wire can't be pushed in, which is why we can't get to him, but it can push out, which is how he can get out. It's a one-way door.
The pool of molten copper crept up toward Foyle.
If he doesn't get out soon, he'll be roasted alive.
We'll have to talk him out. Tell him what to do.
The men began shouting,
Foyle! Foyle! Foyle!
The burning man in the maze continued to move feebly. The downpour of sizzling copper increased.
Foyle, turn left. Can you hear me? Foyle, turn left and climb up. You can get out if you'll listen to me. Turn left and climb up. Then, Foyle. He's not listening. Foyle, Gully, Foyle, can you hear us?
Send for Jizz. Maybe he'll listen to her.
No, Robin, she'll telesend. He'll have to listen.
But will she do it? Save him, of all people?
She'll have to. This is bigger than hatred. It's the biggest damned thing the world's ever encountered. I'll get her.
Yang Yovel started to crawl out. Dagenham stopped him.
Wait, yo, look at him. He's flickering.
Flickering?
Look, he's blinking like a glowworm. Watch. Now you see him, and now you don't.
The figure of Foyle was appearing, disappearing and reappearing in rapid succession, like a firefly caught in a flaming trap.
What's he doing now? What's he trying to do? What's happening?
End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.